Hi, everyone. I'm glad you're with us because after today and next week, we will all be a lot more aware of how our body works, specifically insulin, its effects, and how we can create the insulin balance our body craves, even more than the sweets. Dr. Alan McDaniel is a physician and author who pays attention, recognizes knowledge and clear thinking as family values, and treats patients and all as family. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned for Tributaries. Alan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Robin, what a pleasure to be speaking with you.
You've written many papers and a book and have given many talks to both those in the medical profession and those who want to know how to help themselves and others. And I'm excited that you've agreed to visit with us a few times throughout the coming year to share some of this very worthwhile health information. So I want to thank you for that first off.
Well, it's really a pleasure, and thank you for providing a bully pulpit.
And Alan, you're semi-retired at this point. How do you explain holding on to your enthusiasm all these years? You've got the enthusiasm for your field as a teenager would, I think.
You know, medicine's like my wife. The more I know her, the better I like her. I love medicine. I really think if you believe in Dharma, this is what I'm here for. I have been given experiences that are a bit unusual. My insight has come, and I think that I've found different ways of looking at common things that just makes so much more sense. And I can't wait to tell people about it and to, you know, really try to improve the way the world practices medicine and people take care of themselves.
Yes, well, I appreciate that. You certainly are doing that. And Alan, next I wanted to ask you about your background and what brought you into medicine and then out of its clutches in order to have a true healing practice. But you just mentioned you've had some unusual experiences, so I want to hear about that as well.
Well, I come from a medical family. Every other generation is a doctor. I guess their kids look at the doc and say, no way. But my grandfather was really a paragon of a human being. He trained at Columbia PNS and Bellevue and practiced in his ancestral hometown in Connecticut from the 1890s until his death in the late 1930s. He was an amazing man, and my mother was absolutely in awe of him. My sister is a really smart nurse, and when I was a teenager, she just entranced me with stories about the Washington Hospital Center and her experiences in the emergency room. I have pretty good hand skills, and I trained diversely. I spent a couple of years in general surgery and frankly got burned out. I went to emergency medicine, spent 2 years there doing training at Georgetown, and missed surgery, so went back to ear, nose, and throat, which for a surgical specialty is very medical. In fact, ENT probably deals with more chronic illnesses and chronic problems than any other surgical field. So it shifted my focus from acute emergency to chronic. How did we get here, and what can we do to fix this mess? My chairman of surgery, Dr. Polk, in Louisville, was a big advocate that surgeons should be the most knowledgeable people in the medical management of surgical diseases. And that just made sense. So I really tried to understand what are the causes of these surgical problems and how do we prevent them. Just shortly after becoming a neuro-otologist, I did a fellowship in inner ear surgery with dizziness, particularly. It came to me that I could not rebuild an ear better than the creator or evolution or whatever your philosophy is, than the person was born with. And so for my repair to stick, I had to get rid of the cause of the problem, which led me to allergy, since the ear is, after all, just a fancy sinus that works for a living. And allergy makes sinus trouble, and it makes a lot of the ear problems. And from there, I got interested in alternative approaches to allergy because, frankly, the allergy department at the university wasn't doing a great job of getting my patients ready for surgery. So I found out how to do it better using an alternative approach to allergy, to quote one of Dr. Randolph's book titles. So from there, I found that lots of my people were no longer chronically fatigued. And they sent their friends who were chronically fatigued but didn't have ear disease. And by golly, most of them had allergies, but the allergies turned out to be fairly minor. And so one thing led to another, and I started looking at hormones. And wow, with the hormones, it was truly amazing. You know, our endocrinology is absolutely fantastic. The study of glands and hormones has been developed incredibly. We didn't even have a name for hormone until 1905. So this is a 20th century science. And we have developed along one path, but they bypassed a lot of forks in the road. They couldn't do like Yogi Berra, and so when you come to a fork in the road, take it. They had to take one or the other, and so the fork, the road less traveled, has given me some really great ideas. Because I'm an ignoramus and I'm not an endocrinologist, I was able to get back and read the basic stuff and find places where decisions had been made and important things had been put down. So I've got a sort of an unbiased view to endocrinology, what the Buddhists call the beginner's mind, because, you know, I am a beginner. And the more I read, the better I learn, and my patients do, but the more I realize I'm pretty ignorant, Robin. So what a long-winded, nonstop answer to your question. Did I do better than the politicians last night?
Well, considering I didn't hear them, I would have to say I can't be sure, but I would bet on it, that's for sure. I would bet on it. You know, Alan, it's especially with medicine being so specialized these days, your approach is the best. You know, approach it as coming from a beginner's mind, but also it's refreshing. You know, it's those people that do go to sleep and have a dream or an epiphany or look at something and they don't know what it's like, but they might say, what is that? And why is it doing this? And that's oftentimes where we do get these brilliant shifts for different problems or scenarios that are going on. And I just love how you bring it into medicine. And today we're going to be talking, or you mostly, thank goodness for the audience, we'll be talking about insulin resistance, known as IR. And when most people hear about insulin, their mind wanders right into diabetes. And that's a start, and it's certainly understandable, but this is a story that you're going to share with us today that's going to reach places that many of us will be both surprised and happy to hear about, because it will start answering lots of questions. And so I'm wondering, I don't know if it's best for you to talk about insulin, you know, in the diabetes, or perhaps it's best to start with Dr. Gerald Reven from Stanford, who in 1988 got things rolling in a slightly different direction that's made huge, important differences.
Well, it's always hard to know where to start. We can start about 2,500 years ago with the Vedic physicians from India, Sharak and Susrut, who found that there were two kinds of people who had sweet-tasting urine. There was a group of obese, kind of lazy, they described lassitude people, and then they lived for a very long time. And then there was a group of people who got skinnier and skinnier and died pretty quickly. So 2,000 years ago, they realized there were two different kinds of diabetics. So let me just say that insulin is a hormone without which we cannot live, and it does lots of things in the human body. The most important thing, the thing without which we truly wither and die, is insulin tells our muscle cells and our fat cells to rapidly soak up sugar from our blood, which is incredibly important. When we eat a meal, you know, our macronutrients in the meal are protein, fat, and carbohydrates. And carbohydrates are basically all made of sugar. There are lots of different kinds of sugar, and so there are lots of different kinds of carbohydrates. And glucose is one in particular that our body burns for energy. All our cells need glucose. So when we eat a meal, we get a big rush of glucose going into our body, and our body has to deal with it. So our pancreas, known to the French as sweetbreads, pancreas gets several different kinds of signals to hurry up and release some insulin. And the insulin tells our muscles and our fat cells to soak up a bunch of sugar really quickly. And that keeps our blood sugar level. It gives us nice energy. And all is well. The skinny diabetics who died quickly were unable to make insulin. And they wasted away for lack of energy, and they died quickly because their blood had turned into maple syrup. You know, it was just sugary sludge. And way back in 1921, a brilliant war hero named Banting, who was a surgeon, learned how to isolate insulin and was knighted in Nobel Prize, and big deal. He saved countless people's lives. And it was only recently that the other type of diabetic really got a close look. When I was in medical school back in the mid-70s, our professor said, boys, we don't know what's happening with these dang diabetics. They said that, you know, we used to think that they got so fat they couldn't make enough insulin to keep up with their blood sugar, but now we can measure insulin, and hell, they got plenty. So it turned out these people had insulin resistance, and it's a completely different kind of diabetes that ends up with the same bottom line. Your insulin isn't giving your body the message it needs, but it's a totally different piece. And so docs have had to really retool their brain and change their minds. It's a revolution. And like, you know, people are not losing their heads in this revolution, but we really have to change our minds. So I'm all up for talking about insulin resistance. You want me to just run ahead or give a question?
Well, all of this led, you know, what was it about Dr. Reaven's work that started shifting things? I mean, in one of your papers that I read, you very wisely posed the question, oh, did you think that higher than normal ranges of insulin wouldn't affect people who are insulin resistant? And I think that's what you're talking about. You're talking about
Absolutely.
That there was a big aha moment that, you know, made this question become very much more interesting.
Well, yeah, the aha moment is actually happening right now. It's pretty fascinating. Insulin resistance is a genetic mutation that allowed the people who possessed it to become resistant to death by starvation. It made us, because I carry it, very fuel efficient. We convert our food to energy and store it. And if you look at the other effects of insulin, besides just lowering blood sugar, most of the other effects of insulin, and there are a bunch of them, are energy storage effects. And so people with insulin resistance store energy better. When the food runs out, they're the last people to die. When they have children, the children are bigger, and they grow up into be bigger adults. Most NFL players are insulin resistant. And so it gave a great advantage to survival in primitive times, and therefore, about 40% of Americans are indeed insulin resistant. Raven's huge contribution was this. I mentioned Professor Dunlop saying that people with type 2 diabetes had lots of insulin, but it wasn't working. And so when I was a resident in the emergency room at Georgetown University, one of our professors, I asked in the kind of innocent, gormless way of a young house officer, well, people with lots of insulin, doesn't that insulin bother them? And Mike transfixed me with his steely gaze and said, no, dummy, they're insulin resistant. And what Reaven did was Reaven showed that insulin has lots of other effects. And people with insulin resistance and high insulin develop what's called the metabolic syndrome. And the metabolic syndrome is a huge player in America. In my state, about 35% of us are obese. Not me, thank God, but I know some of the answers to this. And so metabolic syndrome caused by high insulin levels is wreaking havoc on our society. It's responsible for obesity, heart disease, greatly increases stroke, makes cancers grow faster, is the cause of type 2 diabetes, and really messes up reproduction for young women and really sexual morphology for us older guys. 40% of men with metabolic syndrome have low testosterone, and the plumbing doesn't work very well. So, you know, this is a really big deal, and Reaven is the fella who made this landmark presentation at the Banting Lecture in 1988. And we are still just getting our minds around a lot of what he had to say. I went to a lecture on the metabolic syndrome at the University Grand Rounds a few months ago, and the presenter didn't mention the word insulin once, which is kind of incredible.
Well, it seems like it's part of the definition.
Well, it does to me, too. But again, you know, I'm an outsider. So, you know, when you're outside looking in, there's a whole lot more world that you're out in than the little room that the people who you're looking in on.
Right, right. And so what you're saying here, Alan, is that the overall high insulin damages happen years before diabetes will set in.
Well, that's absolutely true. Gosh, one of the things really got my attention 10 years ago or more in the journal of the AMA, somebody was writing about the paradoxes of diabetes, and they said, why is it that type 1 diabetics who have to inject insulin, they have no damage to their eyes whatsoever when they're diagnosed, and it takes 5 years before diabetic retinopathy shows up? Yet people who with type 2 diabetes who have only just gotten high blood sugar already have well-established diabetic retinopathy at the time of the diagnosis. You see, the person writing that thought that all the problems caused by diabetes are caused by high blood sugar. And he or she wasn't thinking, oh, my God, high insulin causes the problems. And injecting insulin, spiking your insulin up and down for 5 years, that leads to retinopathy. There was finally an editorial in JAMA back in 2012 stating that, you know, high glucose is not the sole or maybe even the major cause of problems to diabetics. It's maybe responsible for 25% or less. So it's a complicated issue, but insulin is a big player, and we really have to be conscious and cognizant of the role that high insulin plays.
Right. So insulin resistance basically is when a body has to release more insulin than normal to control the blood sugar.
Yes.
And you mentioned earlier about a gene. Is that simply the base reason?
Yeah, really the base reason. According to Zhao and Keeping in a 2007 article in Current Genomics, the cause of insulin resistance are defective trafficking proteins in the translocation of the high-volume glucose transporter from storage vesicles to the cell membrane. Boy, what a mouthful.
Indeed.
When we eat sugar,
impressed.
Our body makes insulin. Insulin tells our muscle cells, hey, down there, soak up sugar really fast. And in order to do that, the muscle cell has to pull a glucose, like a Hoover, a glucose transporter out of storage stick it in the cell membrane and suck the blood sugar out of the blood really fast. And then when the insulin stops signaling, it pulls the glucose transporter back out of the cell membrane and puts it away. It's amazing. It's like my mother used to put the vacuum cleaner back under the bed when she got finished vacuuming. And the problem in insulin resistance is the proteins that move the glucose transporter from storage to the cell membrane and back again don't work very well. So in order to control our blood sugar, you have to make more insulin than you should. And we used to think, well, that doesn't matter because insulin, you make as much as you need. But because of all of the other aspects, the other things insulin does in our body, that's the problem, you know. Insulin does all sorts of things. Insulin makes us fat. It raises our blood triglycerides and cholesterol. It raises our blood pressure. It makes our body fat. Our daughters reach puberty earlier. We get more stomach acid than we should. Makes tumors grow. I mean, it does an astonishing number of bad things in our body. And the research, there are at least two papers on every one of the problems that insulin generates. So this is kind of like that 100 monkeys thing. There have been so many researchers doing a little bit of work on it that there becomes a mass of information that just has momentum of its own. And I am so trying to get the word out so we can ride the wave of this stuff.
Right. Well, you're doing a brilliant job right now, I would say. Can you share and maybe go into detail of, you know, well, let's take the high blood pressure, and which leads to heart attack and stroke. Can you share a little bit about the specific scenario that does go on with that?
Sure. Well, there are a couple of things. And, of course, what's really fascinating is some of them are interwoven. When insulin levels go higher than normal, it stimulates our brain in the locus coeruleus to make norepinephrine. And that is part of the stress response, and it's part of the fight-or-flight response, and it raises our blood pressure. It makes our heart more jumpy. It makes our heart beat faster. It increases sympathetic tone. Insulin also acts on the hypothalamus, a very ancient part of our brain that regulates our hormones, and it mimics the effects of stress, which, by the way, worsen insulin resistance and also increase norepinephrine. Insulin stimulates the adrenal gland directly to cause the adrenal gland to make adrenaline, which is epinephrine, which acts really similarly to norepinephrine. And these guys all go together to raise the muscle tone, the resistance to the heart that causes high blood pressure. There's a group of physicians at the University of Texas in San Antonio who have very convincingly written that the cause of essential hypertension is insulin resistance. And wow, when I read that, it was amazing, because when I was a medical student, we were told that 90% of high blood pressure is of unknown cause. It's a mystery. And it was like the holy grail of internal medicine. What is causing essential hypertension? Well, now these guys are saying, dude, it's insulin resistance. And by golly, I think they're right. There's a huge study from Spain that just backed them right up on that. So pretty fascinating. And of course, what's rough about insulin resistance is at the same time it's cranking up our blood pressure and making our heart rate faster and a little more irritable, it's also damaging our blood vessels.
Right.
Insulin is pretty darn toxic to the lining of our blood vessels, and that's what causes hardening of the arteries. Insulin also changes the fats in our blood to make them nastier. We get higher amounts of triglycerides, which means we have more small LDL particles, and because there are more particles, they stay out in the bloodstream longer because they got no place to come home to, and they get oxidized, and that damages the lining of our blood vessels. And also insulin increases steroids. And you know, steroids increase our blood pressure, as well as increasing our body fat and our blood sugar. And you get an idea how this stuff can kind of snowball.
Yes, and then the cholesterol gets blamed, which we need good cholesterol, but it's really...
Poor old cholesterol. I'm so sorry for eggs. eggs have been blamed for years, but there's a beautiful study published, I think it's in 1981, way back. The NIH funded a brilliant study for dietary cholesterol, and they just really monitored a large number of people, and they found that the cholesterol in our diet affects our blood cholesterol only 6%. The cholesterol we eat, it's the cholesterol we make.
Sure.
And insulin's a player on that.
And it's really what's going on in the body because it wants to balance, it wants to heal, that it's really a protective mechanism that's going on. So what Western medicine is looking at is, what is this problem? When actually that's the answer, and they need to go underneath that and see why the situation is being created in the first place, of course.
You're exactly right.
Well,
endothelial dysfunction is the phrase that pays these days. What is making the lining of our blood vessels screw up?
Right.
And insulin is a big player in it.
Yes.
People with insulin resistance are 5 times more likely to have a heart attack or a stroke.
Yeah.
It gets my family mostly through vascular disease, not diabetes and obesity. So, you talked about genes. There is the one big gene, but there are other little genes that modifies how it plays. Just like you have a pitcher on the mound in baseball. He's throwing the ball, but the way he twists his wrist, determines how the ball flies.
Yes, and I would have to... I don't know really very much at all about genes and the gene research, but I just have a sneaking suspicion that I don't put much weight into it. I mean, there is so much more going on that, it might mean...
It's a what? It's huge, and we are just in the infancy now. They look at genes like for celiac disease, and they find that maybe 10% of people who have the genes actually have the disease. The vast majority of people with a gene don't express it.
Right.
So why? And not finding a gene is no indication that there's no problem. Like the BRCA A and B, the breast cancer genes, we have found genes that increase breast cancer in families, but we've identified less than 10% of the causes of high breast cancer in certain families. So there's just so much more that we need to learn.
Yes,
you
yes.
You can't put too much stock by it.
Dr. McDaniel will wrap things up next week with how we can prevent and remedy our situations. Diet and lifestyle are key. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. For podcasting on iTunes, Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.